Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we get the latest on Valley fever from our partners at the Center for Health Journalism Collaborative. Harold Pierce of the Bakersfield Californian will join us. Plus, we'll talk to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and find out what they're doing to help fix Lake Isabella's dam. It has three major issues that officials have known about for decades, but a fix is still not quite under construction. Plus, we'll go snowshoeing in the latest episode of our podcast series, Outdoorsy. We begin, though, with a local look at some national issues, specifically U.S. President Donald Trump. The people behind the Valley's biggest industry, agriculture, were some of the president's biggest backers during his campaign. In fact, then-candidate Trump visited Tulare last summer for a fundraiser that brought in $1.25 million. While the president's call to bring more water to the southern San Joaquin Valley through pumping was warmly greeted by many area growers, some have recently raised concerns about the president's other policies, including his stances on trade and immigration. So we sent our reporter, Jeffrey Hess, to the largest gathering of agribusiness professionals in the state, Tulare's World Ag Expo, which just wrapped up its 50th annual show last week. As he reports, the buzz at the show this year wasn't just about new equipment, it was also about Washington.
The Tundra is built to work with features like staggered outboard mounted shocks, heavy-duty.
The World Ag Expo is a noisy place. In addition to the thousands of people milling about the grounds, there are trucks and equipment running on display constantly. And this year, there is political noise surrounding the new president, Donald Trump. Among the farmers I spoke with, there was a broad general hope about the future of the agriculture industry under President Trump. A particularly strong advocate was Robert Franklin, a Trump voter who splits his time between growing apples in eastern Utah and raisins in Brazil. He is hopeful Trump will remove what he sees as government interference, like overtime rules and environmental regulation, which he thinks makes agriculture work harder.
Just leave us alone, let us work hard, let us grow crops, let us feed our neighbors, let us feed the world, let us have healthy food, just let us do it. And so Trump is a man who would take off the regulations to allow us to just work.
Franklin is not at all worried that Trump's approach to trade will make it hard for American farmers to sell their products abroad. There was also little concern among the farmers at the show about the potential for mass deportations of undocumented immigrant workers who are, in large part, responsible for keeping the farm economy going. Julio Ayoa oversees a vineyard in Napa that employs about 60 workers. He voted for Hillary Clinton, but says he now supports Trump. Ayoa suspects he employs undocumented workers, although he admits he doesn't ask too many questions. Still, he says he's not worried that his workers will be sent packing under tougher immigration enforcement Trump promised during the campaign.
They're probably going to go to the process for a while here, and they probably won't get sent back. They're probably going to have to go to the process here if they're being a good citizen throughout the time they've been here. So I don't think Trump's going to send everybody out, but he's sure he's going to send everybody that are bad people. Yeah.
Being that this is the World Ag Expo, foreign companies flock to the show. Lian Yen produces organic fertilizer in China. Speaking through an interpreter, she hopes President Trump will make it easier to export her products to the U.S.
She thought because the new president, Trump, and he came from the businessman, and he know what is valuable for the economy, then she said because our product is better for the United States. And I think she said we have a positive attitude.
Taking the opposite view is August Agner, an American and self-described Republican who makes industrial adhesives in Tijuana, Mexico. He says he's lost faith in the new president because of his loose talk about international trade.
I believe in some of the things he does. I mean, in terms of, I believe in business, but I don't believe in restrictions. So that's about my problem with him right now is restrictions.
The expo did draw a handful of protesters eager to convince the farmers to abandon their support of the new president, primarily based on his perceived animus toward immigrants. Carrying a sign calling for immigration reform and an end to deportations, Suzanne Gundy of Tulare County says she wanted to show her opposition to President Trump right in front of those she thinks supported him.
And we just want to make sure that people are aware that agriculture needs immigrants and that they're in agreement with us. We want to have immigration reform so that we can let the people who are already here be here safely and without being in fear.
Still, even among those who say they support Trump and hope he helps agriculture, there is very much a wait-and-see attitude. Joshua Gritt grows alfalfa in Colorado. He says he voted for Trump and remains cautiously optimistic but wary because he is unsure of how the president's notable unpredictability will play out in the global marketplace.
Biggest concern is consistency. We don't have, to me, it's the volatility makes it very difficult to plan. It's too early to tell. I mean, I'll know a lot more come harvest time.
And that seems to be the overarching feeling that I heard from people I talked to. Trump may hurt, Trump may help, but right now, it's just too soon to tell. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. When Isabella Dam was built back in the 1950s, northeast of Bakersfield, it was hailed as a great engineering achievement. The structure held back the mighty Kern River to provide water for farmers and communities and help protect the southern San Joaquin Valley from floods. But about 10 years ago, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers discovered that the dam had some problems. Geologists discovered an active fault that ran under the dam. There was also a risk the earth and dam could be overtopped during an extreme flood, and the structure had seepage issues at the base. According to Kern County officials, in a worst-case scenario with the reservoir full and a failure of the main dam, some parts of the city of Bakersfield could be under 20 feet of water or more. That possibility led the Army Corps of Engineers, which runs Lake Isabella and the dam, to do two things: change the way they operate the facility by lowering water levels to reduce the risk, and to begin designing a solution to the problems. Joining us now to tell us more about what's already happened and what is soon to happen at Lake Isabella, we have with us now in our studios Sam Winder. He's with the Army Corps of Engineers Isabella Dam Safety Modification Project. He's the senior project manager for that. Sam, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Let's start out with talking about the problems with Isabella Dam as it was designed back over a half century ago, and start with the spillway, since that's what's on everyone's mind nationally and especially in California with what we saw happen in Oroville. What's wrong with the spillway presently at Lake Isabella?
So I'd like to provide one point of clarification.
Yeah.
The spillway itself is operates normally, operates just as we designed it. It's on a good granitic foundation, very solid. We've also operated it several times by necessity when the water levels rise. So we actually know that our spillway works and as designed.
So it's not a structural problem with it like falling apart like we saw in Oroville.
Exactly. The three deficiencies that we know about the dam, first, hydrologically, we know that the watershed, which is about the size of Delaware, actually holds more water than we initially thought in the 1950s. You know, as our science and understanding of the watershed have improved, we realize that there's more water that could potentially be stored in that watershed, and eventually that all drains into the lake. So we know that in a very rare event, we could get more water than what we originally designed the dam for. Now, secondly, as you mentioned, the seismic deficiency underneath the auxiliary dam is a concern. We initially, again, thought that the Kern Canyon Fault was inactive. Again, the science has advanced in those 50, 60 years since then, and we realized it is an active fault. There is no imminent threat. I want to emphasize that. But we want to make sure that our dam can withstand kind of the worst-case scenario. We've studied that fault. We've done a lot of investigations into that, dug trenches across the fault to investigate how it's moved in the past. And because we can specify exactly, you know, the location of where the dam is and what fault it is and how that fault moves, we can incorporate that into our dam design so that we can make sure that we have enough safety factor to mitigate for the worst case scenario if that fault were to become active again. The third issue that you talked about was seepage. As any of the locals know, the Burrell Canal runs through the auxiliary dam. We built that in the 1950s along with the rest of the dam construction, and we suspect there may be some seepage through the canal into the dam. All dams have seepage or some leaking to some extent. We feel that that seepage is beyond modern engineering design standards, and so we want to fix that seepage so that it's no longer a problem.
So going back to this thing with the spillway, you say it's not a problem with it being broken like we saw with Oroville. That's clearly not the case, as there's not even any water near it right now. But you say that there's more water in the Sierra than we anticipated. So what could that do? Is it a matter of the reservoir's not big enough or the spillway can't handle enough water? Why a concern there?
So I want to emphasize this is for extreme events. We're talking storms that come around once every 4,000 years. The storm that we had this year has been, you know, once in a couple, you know, about 22 years is the information I've had. So this is about one in every 25 to 50 years. So when we're designing our improvements, we're looking, you know, extremely rare, extremely large rainfall events. The snowpack actually is not as much of a problem because we have employees who have experience looking at how much snow is in the mountains, and they can forecast how much that snow is going to melt throughout the year, and we can adjust how much water we're letting out of the lake in response to how much we predict is going to be coming in. So the spillway itself isn't large enough to handle a 4,000-year event, so that's why we're going to be excavating a large emergency spillway as part of the modification project.
Again, we're talking about the efforts underway with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to retrofit and improve the Lake Isabella Dam as it holds back the Kern River. In a worst-case scenario, it could cause huge problems in Bakersfield, but that's not likely at this point, partially because you've changed the way you operate the dam. Where are we right now? I understand you're ramping up releases right now to keep it under a certain level. What's going on?
That's correct. We have what's called our restricted pool and a gross pool. So before we discovered the deficiencies in the dams, we had gross pool, which is essentially the entire bathtub is full. So right now our restricted pool, we limit the amount of water to 65% of normal, which keeps us about 20 feet below what water level would be otherwise. And what that does is it gives us about 20 feet of freeboard if we were to experience a seismic event or get a large inflow of water. It gives us time to be able to let more water out and hold back that extra inflow of water while we lower the lake levels. So it gives us kind of an extra margin of safety until we complete our dam safety modifications.
You mentioned that you'll be excavating this new emergency spillway in the dam. What do you do for the two structures, really? It's two earthen dams that we call a little Isabella Dam, the main dam and the auxiliary dam. How do you fix those? What do you do to them? These are rock, earthen structures. It's not Hoover Dam with this big piece of concrete that we think of. How do you fix this thing?
Yeah, that's correct. Both dams are earthen dams. So part of the excavation of the spillway is going to go into our modifications. So the general concept of how we're going to fix the dams is we're going to excavate our emergency spillway. And we know from all of our investigations that that's good granitic rock. It's very solid. You can crush it and make different materials. So we're going to take the rock that we excavate, break it down into smaller pieces, and then place it on the main and the auxiliary dams. We are going to excavate a little bit from the foundation of the auxiliary dam to give it some more buttressing. And then we're going to layer different size materials so that it allows water that seeps through to pass through the dam as opposed to staying there, which is one of our deficiencies. One other advantage to knowing the fault that we have and knowing the possible displacement, we're actually doubling the thickness of each of the layers that we put on the dam so that in the event that we do have an earthquake, any movement of the dam, we have double the safety factor so that we still maintain the performance of the dam.
There's a new article out in the Sacramento Bee talking about the Orville situation, and the report goes on to quote a number of outside officials saying the operational manual for Orville hasn't been updated in 50 years. And they say it doesn't take into account the two largest flood events that California had seen since the dam was built, 1982-83, that big winter storm year, and also the New Year's Eve floods back, I think it was 1997, let alone climate change and how in the future rain and snowfall, the mix could change, and it might result in a different way that people should operate facilities. Have you updated the plan to operate Lake Isabella, and how does that reflect the potential with climate change?
So we have updated in regards to the restricted pool. You know, we're limiting the amount of water that.
So essentially, that's what that is.
Yes, that's the temporary update to our water control manual. Until the dam modifications are complete, that restricted pool will remain in place. Otherwise, we will continue operating in accordance with the water control diagram that has been in place for a number of years. The other point I'd like to make is just because a manual seems older does not mean that it's not up to date and it doesn't satisfy our operational requirements. We're still operating the dam the same way. It's still believe it's safe. We've shown it to be safe with the few times we've had to use the spillway. So we're confident that any updates to the manual that we need to make, we will be making as conditions change. And one other point for updating the manual, it does require authorization and money from Congress in order to make those updates.
I want to move on to that. Now, there's been a lot of concern about the amount of time it has taken since these issues first arose back in the middle of the last decade, around 2005. Some concerns about the seismic activity or potential for seismic activity were raised, and the Corps began studying the issue later that decade. Now we're all the way in 2017. Even House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy issued a statement this week and saying that you know he wants to see this move forward swiftly. What's taken so long to solve this problem?
Well, this isn't an easy problem to solve. There are a lot of moving parts, very complex. We have to take a lot of different stakeholders into account, not just the Corps, but other federal agencies around the lake. We have to think about the Water Master and the local population, and we have to do right by them. So it involves a lot of planning, and during the design phase, for our own internal safety reviews and making sure that the design is correct, takes time. This is a very high dollar value project, and we don't want to go in and do an incomplete design and build something that doesn't hold up later. So we are taking the time to make sure that we are maintaining public safety, and we're building something that's safe and maintains our high standard of quality so that we can continue to operate this dam safely into the future.
When something like Orville happens, I imagine, even though it's not your facility, it's a state facility, I imagine everyone in the industry, whether it's in California or outside, is paying extra close attention. Have you changed anything in what you do at Lake Isabella after Orville? Have you done more inspections, things like that?
We do increase our inspections as the water level rises. This was independent of any other events at another dam. During the drought, we would inspect the actual dam weekly. We would be inspecting our instrumentation every 2 weeks. As the water level rises, that triggers more inspections as we go along. So now with the water level near our restricted pool, we are daily monitoring and inspecting both auxiliary and main dams. We're also checking our instrumentation weekly. If there are any seismic events, last year, almost a year ago, there was an earthquake in Wasco just outside of Bakersfield. Our operations personnel went out immediately and checked all of our instrumentation on our dams to make sure that it was structurally safe. Also, independent of any events that happen outside of Lake Isabella, we do yearly pre-flood season inspections. We did ours in November of 2016 to go along with reviewing our emergency action plan. And also we have a 5-year kind of more in-depth engineering inspection that we completed in November of 2015. So we're completing these monitoring and inspections regardless of what happens either at Oroville or other dams in accordance with some increased risk when the water level comes up. We acknowledge that that's there, and so we are taking the steps to make sure that we're ensuring public safety.
Does the drought factor into any of this in any way? You know, the levels have been down so low for so long. Does that present an interesting challenge in now that, wow, we're seeing water where we haven't seen it in years? Does that add an extra level of complexity not concern, but this is something you pay attention to?
It is a nice change of scenery to have water in all of the lakes again. As someone who lives in California, I appreciate it. It doesn't change our operations, though. We still operate in accordance with our water control manual. It's just we have to pay a little bit more attention now because the water is near our limits. And so we're daily monitoring how much water we're letting out and how much water we are seeing come in or expect to come in. We're looking at the forecasts just as rigorously as we always have. Our operations have not changed. It's just now the water level is a little bit higher.
So walk us through the timeline here. Where are we in terms of seeing actual construction begin on the retrofits that you talk about? And again, how much does all this cost?
So we just finished the complete design for the dams and spillways contract. It's now headed over to our contracting personnel. We're going to ask the large construction contractors to put in their bids, tell us how much they think it's going to cost, how long it will take, how they're going to do the work, small businesses that they're going to be including to work with them. We have our standards that we're going to give to them, and we're going to see if they can beat those standards and get us a better product for the American taxpayer. So we intend to solicit this contract in the next couple months and award by fall of this year. It'll take a few months for equipment to get moving to the site and to start the actual construction, which for the dams and spillways project will be late winter or early spring of next year. However, we are already constructing several buildings for the U.S. Forest Service. They have facilities that are currently in the footprint of where we're going to be excavating. As you can imagine, that's a poor place to have a building when you're trying to blast rock out around it. So we're actually moving them out of the way in order to expedite our construction.
Congress has already approved $85 million for this project. Is that going to be enough to finish the job?
No. So our congressionally authorized cost for the entire project is about $650 million.
Wow. So this remains an issue there to pay for all these changes. Again, talking about the Lake Isabella Dam Modification Project, trying to improve the safety of that structure that opened back in the early 1950s. With all the rain and all the snow that is up in the Kern River watershed right now, do you anticipate having to use the spillway this year? Is that something you want to avoid, or is that a possibility?
So we're operating the water levels to maintain our restricted pool, and at that level, we are not going to be using the service spillway. Based on our projections, we will be remaining at or just below the restricted pool for the rest of this year, peaking around June, July timeframe. There may come a time if we get a large rainstorm where we may temporarily exceed our restricted pool, but we will quickly and aggressively release water in order to get down below that elevation. So we don't anticipate using the service spillway this year.
And speaking of releasing water from the dam, does that also present challenges and concerns in terms of downstream risks with erosion, flooding? How do you try to balance that?
And just like you said, it is a balancing act. We work very closely with the Kern River Water Master, the local population, the farmers in the area, because this is not just one individual piece. It's part of a larger system. And so we have to work with all of our partners and all of our stakeholders to make sure that when we are releasing water, that those downstream interests can take it. And we do have some limits that we think well, we know where we could possibly get some damage downstream, and so we're trying to coordinate.
Where is that?
I don't specifically know where that damage would be, and I don't want to speculate, but we do have kind of a self-imposed limit to make sure that we don't cause any damage downstream unless it's absolutely necessary.
Again, we're talking with Sam Winder today with the Army Corps of Engineers Isabella Dam Safety Modification Project. Sam, thanks so much for joining us today.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Animal shelters in the San Joaquin Valley are inundated every year with thousands of rescued dogs, cats, and even pigs. But what happens to the animals that no one seems to want? While some shelters may euthanize, others go to great lengths to keep them alive. FM 89's Carrie Klein has the story of a creative solution to a supply and demand problem.
It's almost 11 p.m. in an industrial zone of South Fresno. A small back lot near Highway 99 is dark, except for the headlights of a van with tinted windows. Hooded figures are loading up the van with plastic crates. One opens the door to survey the cargo.
Hello, everybody!
Brenda Mitchell is the co-founder of Animal Compassion Team in Fresno. She's here with a troop of animal shelter workers.
Is that all of them?
That's all of them.
And their cargo? Chihuahuas.
So we have Lisa Flower, Penny Roger, Princess Leia, Luke Skywalker.
Their rescues, strays, and fosters being sent off to a new life.
Butler, RJ, Puccini, Shiloh, Ava, Nutmeg.
Mitchell says out of the thousands of animals rescued here each year, Chihuahuas wind up staying in shelters longer than practically any other breed.
They're not getting adopted here. It's one of the hardest breeds that we have to find homes for here in the Valley, pit bulls and Chihuahuas.
So this late-night maneuvering is their solution. It's part of an ongoing program that transports unwanted Chihuahuas out of the Valley and into areas where tiny dogs are in short supply. In 4 years, the program has relocated over 1,400 Fresno Chihuahuas. It's a sum that wasn't easy to reach because their new homes are in Minnesota.
It's quite a production to load up 40 Chihuahuas and fly them across the country. But it's always wonderful to load them up and to see them go and then to see the happy faces on the other end from the wonderful people there.
A shipment of around 40 Chihuahuas goes out every 6 weeks or so. Before the dogs fly, veterinarians like Cindy Karsten from UC Davis travel to Fresno to evaluate their temperaments and medical conditions.
These guys, the biggest things are their teeth, heart murmurs, knees, eyes. We've had a lot of eye issues this trip.
Karsten thought of the idea for this program when she was working in the area.
The whole reason it started is I was at Clovis, and they said they had some Chihuahuas that had been there over a year, and I was like, this is insane.
She's from the Midwest, and she knows how much people there want tiny dogs. So she founded this program with a nonprofit group, Compassion Without Borders. They coordinate the flights and raise the money to make this all happen. It's cheaper than you might think. Costs really only include gas to and from the airport and around $60 for each dog to fly in cargo. All the labor is done by volunteers.
So do you like look forward to these trips?
Oh, love it. Yes.
Once the dogs reach the Midwest, Sally Thornton says Minnesotans are just clamoring for them. Thornton is with the Animal Humane Society, which distributes the arrivals to 5 shelters in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. She says for most of their animals, it takes around 10 to 12 days to be adopted.
But once, specifically when the California Chihuahuas get to the adoption floor, I would say most of the time they're adopted within a few hours to about 3 days is typical.
And they go to homes like these.
This is Senor Pico. This is Lavella, and then this is Sally T. She was the 1,000th Chihuahua that was adopted.
Annalise and Nick Ludwig have 2 kids and 3 California Chihuahuas. They fell so in love with their first, Senor Pico, that Annalise and her husband would stalk the shelter's website waiting for new arrivals.
He was even given the job of standing outside the Humane Society on a blistering cold day to make sure that we were the first people to get an opportunity to adopt Sally T because I had already fallen in love with her.
Brenda Mitchell and the other Fresno volunteers say knowing the dogs are going to good homes is what helps them say goodbye. Besides, at that point, it's already time to rescue the next wave of Chihuahuas. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. For many people who contract Valley fever, the symptoms are minimal. In fact, most people don't even know they've had the airborne fungal disease that's spread by spores throughout the Southwest, including the San Joaquin Valley. But Bakersfield resident Juan Solis is not one of those people. He's lucky to be alive after contracting the disease in 2008. In his case, it spread from his lungs to other parts of his body. And the drug that helps keep him alive has serious consequences. His story is documented in a new report by Harold Pierce of the Bakersfield Californian in the series Just One Breath. The series is a product of the Center for Health Journalism Collaborative. Valley Public Radio is also a member of the collaborative. In fact, Juan's story is the lead article on KVPR.org today. Harold joins us now. Harold, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me, Joe.
So before we get to this terrible catch-22 situation that Juan is in with the medication that keeps him alive, let's go back to the beginning. Who is Juan Solis, and when did all of this begin?
Yeah, Juan Solis is he's a Bakersfield resident, and before he got sick with Valley fever in 2008, he designed trusses for homes that are being built out here. And this started one day. He was generally an office guy. He did work in the office, but occasionally he had to go out and work on some trusses outdoors, obviously. He caught a windy day. It was dusty out, and he caught Valley fever. He didn't know it was Valley fever for the first 6 or 7 months, though. His doctors told him, you know, everything under the sun, that he was, you know, he was getting night sweats because he was stressed out, because he was overweight, because, you know, they sent him to an optometrist, check for the pressure in his head. They sent him to all kinds of different specialists trying to figure out what was wrong with him, when really it was Valley fever. So by the time it had progressed and developed, it actually turned into coxemeningitis, which is a rarer complication when that fungal spore that you breathe in that causes Valley fever disseminates throughout your bloodstream.
So all of a sudden, what is in most cases, for most people, not the most severe sort of disease, for him, very, very severe, in fact, life-threatening.
Right. This is one of the rare cases. And like you said, you know, Valley fever, for a lot of people, you get it, you don't even know you have it. And you generally develop an immunity to it for most cases, most people, that is.
So in his case, I guess you could say there's good news, is there's some medication that can help him, but it's a lot more complicated than that. What did
right.
doctors do, and what did they prescribe?
Right. The medication is kind of the catch-22 we're talking about. It's called voriconazole, or VFN for short. It's an antifungal drug, and it wasn't developed for Valley fever. None of the drugs that are used to treat Valley fever were created for Valley fever. In fact, they're all kind of used off-label, as they call it. And the problem with this particular drug is that, first off, it's expensive. But the other thing that's really detrimental is that it causes extreme photosensitivity. It's sensitive to light at that point. So Juan has trouble going outdoors now. He can't step into the sun. He's developed skin cancer. The skin cancer is so severe now that he has to go to the dermatologist every 3 to 5 weeks or so to have his dermatologist scrape lesions off of his skin. It's pretty detrimental to his health, and I think his wife said it best. You know, you either die of Valley fever quickly or you die of skin cancer really slowly, and right now they've chosen to go with the voriconazole treatment because what other choice do they have?
And you mentioned it's expensive. That is also an issue for him because insurance was an issue.
Insurance was an issue, yeah, yeah. And I think that drug can generally cost, for the dosage that Juan is on, it's a pretty high dosage, roughly about $900 a month or so. He's gotten on enough different health care plans and through Obamacare and things like that that he's got it down significantly cheaper, but it is an expensive drug. Yeah.
Why didn't the doctors suspect it earlier? Has he asked that question, and is there any answer? I mean, this is in an area that is endemic to Valley fever. Are physicians not looking out for this enough? Are you hearing that?
You know, that was a while back. That was 2008 when he was initially diagnosed. I'd like to think there's been a greater level of awareness since then. You know, the collaborative that we work with has put together this project, I think, in 2012 or so. I'd like to think there's a heightened level of awareness now. But I think that one of the bigger problems is physicians in Kern County, because of the area it's located in, you have a lot of physicians who are kind of at the revolving door area. You know, new physicians come in. By the time they get to learn what the symptoms are for Valley fever and get to diagnose them quickly and become very good with it, they're ready to pack up and go somewhere else. It's kind of a difficulty for healthcare in this area, is what I've heard from a lot of doctors.
So essentially, Juan is going to be living with this condition the rest of his life. This drug isn't a cure, right?
No, this drug is not a cure. This drug holds it at bay. And I think one of the saddest things about the story is that we were there at the dermatologist's office, and we were talking to his doctor, and we had asked the question, well, if they develop this treatment for Valley fever out in Arizona, they're working on this drug called Nicomycin Z right now that has cured Valley fever in lab rats. If they develop that, if they get it to human trials, if it actually works, and if he takes it, is the skin cancer going to subside? And the answer is no, absolutely not. It's just gone way too far at this point, and he's going to be living with that the rest of his life. So I think that's probably the saddest part of the story.
And his family is affected too. His wife, I know, is caring for him now. What is the family situation there like? How has this put strain on them?
You know, I think it's really tough. I think they just gotten to the point, actually, where they've moved homes from the Southwest just this past weekend, I think, when the story ran. They moved to a smaller home. But I think that Julie now is, you know, the wife, she's really fighting to bring more awareness to Valley fever. She's going to be very dedicated her life to this. I mean, it wasn't just her husband who got Valley fever. Obviously, he got the more severe case of it. But as soon as they found out that his diagnosis, they went out and tested the rest of the family, and their daughter had Valley fever as well. She had developed it. So they got her on the drug, I think, fluconazole, and I think for about 6 months or so, she was on that drug, and she had gotten better. She doesn't show any symptoms anymore, but it just goes to show that this can affect absolutely everybody who's out here living in the Southern San Joaquin Valley and breathing the air.
You can find Harold's latest story about Valley fever and Juan Solis on bakersfield.com. Also, it's the lead story on kvpr.org today. It's all part of this project called Just One Breath. It's a collaboration with the Center for Health Journalism at USC, and the Californian and Valley Public Radio are partners in that. Harold, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
This is Valley Public Radio. Stay tuned. The latest edition of our outdoors podcast, Outdoorsy, is next.
If you're just going out for a day and you don't go out very often, I would virtually 100% of the time tell you to go snowshoeing. Within 5 minutes, you'll be having a good time.
Hey guys, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This is Outdoorsy, a podcast from Valley Public Radio.
We take you to wild places in Central California and introduce you to people who explore them.
Today, we're taking advantage of the season and venturing out into the snow.
We've gotten a lot of it this winter, so it's the perfect opportunity for snowshoeing and cross-country skiing.
Or at least snowball fights.
Yeah, we'll take you to a few places near the valley to play in the snow. We'll help you get equipped and then tantalize you with a sugary delicacy that's wildly popular in Shaver Lake.
So let me say first, Ezra, that I love winter. As long as I'm bundled up with nice warm gear, I adore snow and seeing my breath in the air and hearing ice crunching under my feet.
Well, Carrie, I don't love winter as much as you, but I do love everything about snowshoeing. I think that's because I'm a big hiker. In my early 20s, my friends and I had a tradition of snowshoeing on New Year's Day every year in Sequoia National Park.
Yeah, that sounds really lovely. And that's a great place to go, too. But in my mind, hardly anywhere is more magical in the winter than Yosemite National Park. I went on two snowshoeing forays this winter, and Yosemite was the first. I went with three friends over Christmas weekend when you may remember there was a big storm. We drove in as the snow started falling, and we settled into Half Dome Village, formerly Curry Village, in a heated tent cabin. And we listened to the snow and ice fall on the tent roof all night. The next morning, snow plows were out, snow chains were on, and people were slip sliding all over the paths between buildings. We pulled out our snowshoes and decided to take a nice big tour of the valley, walking from Half Dome Village to Mirror Lake, then back along Tenaya Creek with a stop at the majestic Yosemite Hotel for some hot chocolate. Before we started, my friend Alon pulled out a map.
And we were thinking if we take the upper path, then we could continue that along the Royal Arches.
Yosemite Valley's greatest hits.
You got it. So we set off, and as soon as we found the path off the road, we stopped to strap on our snowshoes.
So this goes through this hook. Oh, it's probably actually easier if we put each other's on.
If you've never put snowshoes on before, they might seem a little tricky, but they're really pretty foolproof.
Oh, there's actually an indication on the snowshoe. Oh. Like it says ball of foot goes here.
So we took off. Within a few minutes, though, we were under a lot of tree cover. That means there were all these bare patches with hardly any snow, and our snowshoes kept scraping on rocks and dirt.
The snow's gone.
So almost as soon as we started, we took the snowshoes off.
You gave up?
Yeah, on the snowshoes, but the walk was still beautiful. And with more snow, it would have been perfect. But that's the nature of weather, right? So whether or not there's snow, I highly recommend spending a night or two in the park this time of year and enjoying it without the summer crowds. Even in the tent cabins, there's heat.
So that was snowshoe trip number one?
Right. So a few weeks later, I got some real snowshoeing in, this time at a snow park. My fiancé Jess and I took off east out of Fresno along Highway 168 and watched the snow grow deeper and deeper on the side of the road as we climbed into the mountains. We finally stopped at Tamarack Ridge, a snow park between Shaver and Huntington Lakes. There are a few snow parks along this stretch of 168. Tamarack Ridge is good because it has lots of trails for snowshoeing, cross-country skiing, and snowmobiling.
Don't you need a permit for snow parks?
Yeah, and passes are pretty cheap. You can get a day pass for $5, but you can also get a season pass for $25. They were available in about a half dozen stores in Shaver Lake, but you can buy them online or by mail, too. So when Jess and I got to Tamarack Ridge, it was packed with little kids sledding and building snowmen and families tailgating in the parking lots. Jess and I waded through the folding chairs to the sign at the trailhead.
I believe that we are here.
It's huge. It's been lifted above the snow level so you can get your bearings and plan your route.
So I think that our probably best bet would be to do the Raven Trail to the Shaver Lake Vista.
So we set out on a 4-mile loop, and just 100 feet or so in, we were the only ones there. We had 6 feet of pristine, untouched snow all to ourselves.
Sounds perfect.
Yeah, it was quiet and serene and beautiful, but it also meant we lost the trail.
The path just disappears.
That actually happened to us a few times.
All right. Let's turn around again.
But it's not a big deal, right? Because unless 3 feet of snow have fallen in the last hour, you can still see your footsteps and retrace them. So we went for a few hours and probably still got 3 or 4 miles in.
So it still sounds like a successful trip. One of the first times I rented snowshoes, it was sort of a disaster. The place messed up and gave me 2 shoes for right feet. It made the trip harder than it should have been. I fell a few times and the shoes made me want to veer right the entire time. To spare first-timers from experiences like mine, I found a local expert.
Camping department, this is Scott.
Scott Shively is an avid snowshoeer and skier, as well as the manager for the backpacking, camping, mountaineering, and snow-related section of Herb Bauer Sporting Goods in Fresno. He says so far this year, snow levels in the Sierra Nevada are perfect for snowshoeing, but the elevation of snow here can present a problem for newbies.
And we've had good snow, and I would say it's very good conditions this year. However, the last few storms have been a little bit on the warmer side, and of course that means that the snow level will go up and up and up. Realize also that our snow is at higher elevation and there's less oxygen up there. It's much easier to get tired. I always tell people, you know, leave the day going, I could have gone further versus, oh my gosh, I'm still 2 miles from the car and I'm just dying here. What do I do?
Herb Bauer rents and sells cross-country skis and snowshoes.
Yeah, that's actually where I got my snowshoes.
Yeah, Scott fitted me with a pair of large ones. He says you don't need special shoes for snowshoeing, just waterproof hiking boots.
And then you get your foot about to that, there's a ball of the foot section, so your toe will hang over the binding just a little bit. You don't want it to hang over too much. because then you're, as you're moving up and down, it's not going to close. And then depends on your footwear, you'll snug it down. Super easy to put on and off when you don't have gloved hands. When you have a gloved hand, it's a little bit more difficult.
Scott says if you're just going out for a day and it's your first time, then it's best to rent. It's about $40 a weekend to rent skis, boots, and poles, and under $30 for snowshoes. A new pair of snowshoes is around $150, and a whole ski system can cost $500 or more. He says ski poles aren't necessary for snowshoeing, and he says the sport is easier to get into than skiing.
If you're just going out for a day and you don't go out very often, I would virtually 100% of the time tell you to go snowshoeing. Within 5 minutes, you'll be having a good time. You're not going to be able to go as far, because you can probably go about half as far as you can walk. So if you are used to walking 5 miles on a hike during the summer, you probably are going to go about 2.5 miles under that same amount of time.
For snowshoes, Scott says it's imperative that you have the right size and maybe even have extensions for them so you don't sink into the snow. Extensions are tails that you clip on to the end of snowshoes to increase the surface area, meaning you won't sink.
So when you say size, you mean like shoe size?
Not exactly. The size of snowshoes depends on how much you weigh. The heavier you are, the larger snowshoes you'll need to keep from sinking into the snow.
I'm about 180 pounds. I probably about 25% of the time would need a tail, and 75% of the time wouldn't. But virtually every day I go out, 25% of that day I need tails. So I pretty much need to own tails. And tails cost about $40 to $50.
When it comes to skis, the investment is a lot larger. You'll need skis, bindings, poles, and boots. Besides the actual hardware for these activities, Scott says it's important to wear the right kind of clothing. Outerwear that breathes easy and is waterproof. As for where to go, Scott says there are so many places to have fun in the snow in the Sierra Nevada.
Is there like an epic place that you like to go to?
Well, I'm going to tell you, and then you know everybody's going to be there. The place that I would say is the most guaranteed for snow is Tamarack. Because Tamarack, it's just in this little valley. If you've got an outdoor thermometer on your car, you'll watch it go from 25 to 17, and then it'll go back up to 25. That valley that Tamarack's in just is, geographically positioned in a way that it really gets cold. So when it's raining in that area, the place that's the coldest is probably going to get the most snow. The place that's the coldest is probably going to hold the snow longest.
Hey, another vote for Tamarack Ridge.
And another place to snowshoe is Sequoia National Park. There are guided moonlit tours that run through the Sequoia Parks Conservancy every month while there is still snow on the ground.
Okay, so you've rented your snowshoes, gotten a nice workout, and triumphed in a snowball fight, perhaps, and you're ready to head home and grab a snack. If you've gone somewhere along Highway 168 in the mountains, there's a place in Shaver Lake where you might want to stop for a dessert with an intriguing history. The store is called Shaver Coffee and Deli, and it's a combination food counter and convenience store on the main drag in town. They sell a lot of food, smoothies and ice cream, tri-tip sandwiches and burritos, but they've got one clear bestseller. When I walked in, two Fresno State students were standing by the door devouring a sugary, gooey-looking dessert. They hadn't even sat down. They were just standing by the cash register, picking the dessert out of the container with their fingers.
It just melts in your mouth, and it's very soft and moist. It's incredible. She introduced me to it, and I was just trying to just take a bite, but I can't stop eating it. It's so good.
This dessert is called Chunky Bread. Cook and manager Shauna Curtis says it's their number one selling product.
Yeah, I get it every time I go to Shaver Lake.
My most accurate way to describe it is it's like the center of a cinnamon roll, but it's a whole loaf of it. Like the best part of a cinnamon roll, you get a whole big loaf of it.
It's their own version of something you've probably heard of called monkey bread.
We start with French bread dough and chop it up and roll it around in cinnamon and sugar and then cover it with our goo mixture and just bake it. It's super simple, and I think that's part of what makes it so awesome is that there's not a whole lot going on with it.
Wait, stop. Goo mixture?
Yeah, I've never had a conversation where we said the word goo so much. And it's exactly what it sounds like. This sticky, sugary, buttery, cinnamony substance that holds the little dough balls together. And Shauna's deliberately mysterious about what it is.
So what's in the goo mixture?
I can't tell you that. That's our smoking gun. It's the goo.
And it's got appeal. On a busy day, Shauna tells me they can easily sell 200 loaves of the stuff.
And then, like, how many pounds of, like, flour do you go through in a day, or butter or anything like that?
Like, 160 pounds, probably, of dough. God, that's so much when I think about it multiplied like that.
So this gooey, chunky bread, it's a secret recipe. And what's interesting is it's not a family recipe, it's a community recipe.
The recipe for the chunky bread has been in the town for upwards of 50 years, and it's just been passed around from business to business. So every business that has had it has had success with it, and we just happen to be the one that has it now.
Shauna thinks it was first made by a woman named Edna.
It was her, like, homemade recipe that she just made at home, and then they started making it over there at the village, and it's just continued on since then. I think that it was here before under another owner, and the restaurant across the street, the cafe, was the village, it was Angelo's, it was the Falls, and all of those places have had it at one point or another.
What's keeping other businesses from getting the recipe?
We keep it a secret. The exclusivity of it is part of what makes it so popular, I think, the fact that you can only get it in one place. Other restaurants in town have tried to kind of mimic it, but it's just not the same.
It sounds like an honor system that's really working.
Yeah, when a community gets together on something, it can be pretty impressive. And delicious. And that's today's show. Check out our website for places to enjoy the winter, and share a picture of snowshoeing or enjoying chunky bread on Instagram or Twitter. We're at OutdoorsyPod on both.
Our editor is Joe Moore, and we had engineering help from Don Weaver.
Our intern is Laura Sutsui. Our music is by Kevin McLeod and Ben Sound.
Stay tuned for future shows when we visit other wild places and interview the people who love them. For Outdoorsy, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Carrie Klein. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition broadcast. As always, we'd like to hear from you. Send us your thoughts and comments about Outdoorsy or the rest of the show. We are talk@kvpr.org and on Twitter @kvpr and @Valley Edition. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.